And the next thing on our agenda is to hear about the tax incidence project. Paul, you can tell us a little bit about that, and then I am going to ask Senator Byer, who's on the committee, to also comment.
Madam Chair, the tax incidence project, really the kind of the origins of it go back to the governor's tax review process that took place in the last interim. And the technical advisory committee is chaired by John Mitchell. Recommended that the state develop a tax incidence model. And that led to some legislation or to a bill that was proposed by Representative Rasmussen that passed the House Revenue Committee, but did not end up passing in Ways and Means. But what did was in the budget reconciliation bill, 5511, Senate Bill 5511, there was money set aside for a tax incidence project, $300,000. I went to the emergency board last week, and they authorized the use of the first $150,000 of that. The tax incidence project really has two objectives, as and you can see in your material before you, and these objectives, you can do one without two, but usually if you did two, you would also do one. But the first objective is to provide taxpayers with and policymakers with information on the overall distribution and the ultimate burden of taxes. And really, this grew out of a lot of the discussion about the taxes paid by businesses versus households, in which there's noted the changing relative shares there, the amount of taxes. But that discussion is all focused on what economists call the legal incidence, or who actually writes the check. Economic incidence traces that out and looks at who ultimately bears the burden, and one of the common statements in public finance is that people pay taxes in some form or another, and they pay them either as consumers or as stockholders, as workers, so that people ultimately bear the burden of taxes. And what this will do is allow us to take it a step further and look at who bears the ultimate burden of taxation. We have some good models of this. I think probably the best one is the Minnesota study that's been done in recent years, Minnesota Department of Revenue, that is I think the best example of objective one. We also have as a second objective is to taking that a step further in what's sometimes called a full incidence model, which will allow us to identify and quantify behavioral responses. Really, you get there, at least partially there, through any kind of analysis of the first objective, the distribution and ultimate burden of taxes, because you have to assume that people do something in response to the tax. That's what economists call elasticities. If you, for example, raise the gas tax, then consumers respond in some way to a higher price. So there's some behavioral response to that. Same thing is true of cigarette tax, for example. We've often looked at how consumers respond when Oregon raises its cigarette tax. And that's getting at this behavioral response. What we propose to do in the second objective, though, is to develop a comprehensive, what's called a general equilibrium model, to look at the overall economic effects of changing taxes. So the best example of this, I think, is the California model, which has been developed over the last 5 years or so. They will go through in any proposed legislation that has a revenue impact of $10 million or more. They'll run it through their full incidence model, the general equilibrium model, and trace through what these secondary effects will be in the economy. We have been in close contact with California, and they'll certainly help us in developing this.
Senator.
I'm not quite sure where this fits in with the behavioral part, but last week when I was at CSJ, I was sitting with my Idaho counterparts visiting, and I was recalling when we moved back to Oregon from Idaho in exactly the same size house. Everything was the same. The taxes in Oregon were twice as high as they were on that same house in Oregon. But the griping about taxes was the same in both states. There was no difference in the concern about high taxes. And I guess I'm saying there is a behavioral thing about taxes. I think you could cut them in half. It wouldn't be long before, even if it was constant, it wouldn't be long before everyone would be complaining about high taxes. And I think it's a behavioral kind of a thing, you know, about taxes. But it was an interesting one because it's exact same size housing, but the taxes were exactly twice the size.
Paul has said before that that's the BA effect. Some bellyaching.
Well, it's an interesting one. It was kind of a fun discussion.
Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of behavior, we're also talking about economic behavior as far as...
How you change, yes. No, I understand.
Yeah. I think the biggest change might take place about taxes and what we pay for... Of course, you're talking about... If I understood your story right, you were talking about complaining in Idaho versus Oregon and...
Whatever.
And of course, we all only have our own thing to compare. We don't compare what Oregon's doing.
Right.
I mean, what Idaho's doing, and really don't care because we live here and have to pay these.
Right. And they felt the same.
Right.
Right. But it was.
So yeah. Which is why we're going to need to look at what we're going to do to backfill, reduce $1 billion, because I do believe bill size on its measure it will pass. So we should be thinking. We should be forward thinking. I just don't think that people are not going to pass that. We better be planning now.
We prepare for it. I think you're right.
So, Madam Chair, I've kind of laid out the structure there that we've set up to carry out the project. We have two committees. The first is a tax incidents oversight committee. Of which Representative Wynn is the chair. Senator Beyer is on that committee, along with Representative King and Senator Nelson. And then we also have four other people on that committee, non-members. Elizabeth Harshenko, the Director of Department of Revenue, Olivia Clark from the Governor's Office, and then Gary Carlson from Industry and Tim Nesbitt from Labor to give us some overall direction in terms of the project and help us with particularly with disseminating the results of it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues that committee will address is to give us some guidelines in terms of when to use the model.
I see.
Particularly during the session. Now, well, what will come out of this report will be a report that will be issued in the beginning of 2001 session. It'll have distribution of the tax burden by deciles, for example, and then we'll also look at some major proposals, for example, shifting to a consumption tax. What would that do in terms of behavioral effects? And those would obviously be a huge change in Oregon's economy. We also have a model review group, which is really people that are with technical expertise that we've asked to work with us closely in developing the model and to balance our assumptions off of and give us some input on that in terms of data and so forth. We have set up a model building team, and the approach that we have decided to use and been approved by the Policy Oversight Committee is what we call an in-house approach. By in-house, though, I'm really talking about in-house, including our own university system.
Mm.
In which we will have a contract with Oregon State University. Bruce Weber will be heading the model building team. We have Dave Holland, who's a Washington State University professor, who will be on sabbatical next year, will be down working with us. Ed Waters is our point person from legislative revenue. Ed's has a lot of experience in the general equilibrium model building and has worked closely with Bruce Weber over the years. So I think we're fortunate to be in a situation where we have the expertise here. It's great. We do plan to use some of the project money for consultants to give us a critique, a review, an analysis of what we've done as we go through the project, as we reach a preliminary draft phase, so that and there are major national firms, accounting firms, Pricewaterhouse, for example, that have done these models before for other states. So we can use some of their expertise and help us, give us some insight and help give us credibility.
Right. Any questions or comments about what Paul has said? And then I'm going to ask Senator Beyer to kind of comment about the project and his looking on it. Go for it.
Yeah.
Go for it. Come on.
Well, I think this is, I'm very pleased to see that we chose to fund this thing. I think it's important. One of the frustrations, as you'll both recall, when we were talking in the session about, well, the single sales factor comes to mind, but a lot of other ones came up too, was what the effect of that was. And our system, at least since I've been here, the LRO has done an excellent job, but it's all been on what they call the static. You only get the downside. What happens if you do this? Kind of this is how much revenue you lose, and you don't get the dynamic side, which is what potentially could happen, nor do you get what's the effect through the system. And I don't think you'll get that without having the tax incident capacity in-house, which is one of the reasons I think it was really important to make it an internal process using Dr. Weber at Oregon State, who has, for those who've been around this stuff a while, has a very good statewide and to some extent a national reputation in this. And we learned that Ed has done a lot of work on this. In fact, his graduate work is on these kinds of models, so he has some in-state things. And probably with that, beyond developing the model itself, it's developing something that people have a sense of credibility around in the session. And I think not the policy group so much as the model group that's there is really using the strength that we have in the state and a broad breadth of it. So when we get to looking at these things, both in terms of when we say this is the incident, this is really who pays the taxes in Oregon now, there will be some sense that people agree with that when we get to the end. And I think that's important that you have it. The strength of the system, I think, for the legislature is not the policy question. It's that the data that you're making the policy question on is acceptable and people have confidence in it, so you're using good data to make policy decisions. And I think this gets us there, and it's a real gap that we have now and probably could not have done a couple of years ago because of the lack of computer power. It's just that we're at a point with technology where we can actually do these and to have a fairly degree of accuracy. So I think that's important to get there. It'll be very helpful to us next session and future legislatures, particularly as you build the strength of the model. It's probably equally important to keep in mind that the first run out that we have of it is going to be subject to a lot of criticism. It's anytime you build a model, and as we've experienced with the state forecasting methodology and some of the other things, the school financing, the more we use it, the better it will get. It has an improvement factor built into it. And that's tied to, I think, using our own staff and our extended staff through the state systems to get there. So there's a lot of good things, and it may sound like a big number to spend $300,000, but I think the payback for Oregonians in the legislature would be show it to be a very good investment.
Now, do we know exactly when is the first meeting and that sort of thing? I mean, has that developed to a point where we're actually moving into sort of a schedule of when all these things are going to begin anyway? I know now that there are some finances that have been released and some money, so that might help.
Yes, Madam Chair, we have already met initially with both groups, both the Oversight Committee and the Model Review Work Group. The reason for that was to recommend an approach. You notice under my tasks there, the first one is to select an approach. We've done that, basically. We had the other option we were looking at would have been to have less of it done in-house, to contract more out. One option would have been basically to purchase a modeling system. One we were looking at is called RIMI, which builds models for states. And we could have purchased that model, tailored it, made some adjustments to it, and really what it amounted to doing more contracting out of the actual model building.
Mm-hmm.
But what the committee's recommended doing was to go ahead and do that in-house and use contractors to review and critique. So that was the key decision that's been made. As far as really the approach that we wanted to take. We are now in the data gathering phase. We plan, Ed and I plan an all-day meeting with Bruce Weber and Dave Holland and also David Craybill, who's a professor at Ohio State, will be working with us on this. So we plan an all-day meeting in January, mid-January.
I see.
And to really go through and iron out the framework of the model.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how voluminous the reports and things are, the runs that give the California, the Minnesota system put out, but it might be good for both Senate and House revenue committees to at least have a sample so they know what those things might look like when they start getting them.
Mm-hmm.
As you're starting to build capacity, so if there's other things they want, you might know.
We can certainly do that, Senator. And, you know, we will keep the committee informed as we go through. We should be making a lot of progress between our interim revenue meetings. We should be able to update you.
Sounds great. Yeah. Any other questions or discussion? Ed, did you have anything to add? Okay. That brings us to our next agenda item, which is child care credit. And let's see, do we have Wendy? Okay, Wendy. Invite you to come up and Dad, you're going to take over here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ed Waters, Legislative Revenue Office. I wanted to very briefly walk you through what kinds of tax benefits are available to Oregonians and then turn things over to Wendy and Dave from the Child Care Financing Task Force to bring us up to date on what some of their thoughts and recommendations were regarding the system. Referring to the handout that was provided, the first one that was provided, Oregon tax benefits for child care. Basically, there are three categories of tax benefits available. The first are personal income tax credits available for individuals. Second are certain tax credits for employers who provide child care services to their employees. And finally, employer-provided dependent care, basically a federal deduction that Oregon can piggyback onto. Oregon personal income tax credits, we have a child and dependent care credit, which has been on the books since the late 70s, mid-70s, I believe. It's calculated as 30% of eligible dependent care expenses. Those maximum expenses are limited. And the credit phases out for taxpayers above $45,000 in federal taxable income. In 1997, we initiated the Senate Bill 388, which started another child care credit as well as an earned income credit for Oregon taxpayers. Child care credit was targeted toward the lowest income taxpayers, calculated as a maximum 40% of eligible child care expenses. And eligibility for that credit phases out if your taxable income, adjusted gross income, was greater than 200% of federal poverty level. Just to give you an idea of what that figure means, 1999 estimate of the federal poverty level for a three-person household is approximately $14,000. So that 200% of federal poverty level was approximately $28,000 or $27,800, actually. The second portion of that 1997 Senate Bill 388 was the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit, which is simply calculated as a fixed 5% of the federal earned income tax credit, but non-refundable in this case. As far as employers are concerned, there is a dependent care assistance information and referral credit, as well as a dependent care facilities credit, and these are available to employers who provide child care services or child care information for their employees, or actually go ahead and build a child care facility. And it's basically a corporate income tax credit. The largest users are corporations.
Could I just ask a question about that? You mentioned that they could give information. What kinds of information typically do they include in that? Are they different? Does it go kind of all across the board? Are they examined in order to qualify for a credit? Or?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I know for the second part there, for the facilities credit, that if an employer were going to build a facility, that would have to be certified by the child care division.
Mm-hmm.
For the assistance information and referral credit, basically I think the thinking there was that firms might be hiring staff to serve as a clearinghouse or point person to provide information and assistance to employees looking for child care services, and or actually maybe having a partnership arrangement with an organization with a firm that provides child care. The last component is the employer-provided dependent care, which is a basically an employer's payments for an employee's dependent care expenses, as well as employee's contributions to a dependent care account up to $5,000 per year. It can be exempt from the employee's personal income tax. And you hear that sometimes referred to as a cafeteria plan benefit or flexible
Yes,
sort of a thing.
Is that the one when they talk about flexible earnings, flexible spending accounts where you, it's a deduction from either this is what we're talking about?
Right. This is one of the areas that qualifies under those kinds of plans. Next page, I've provided you a legislative history of the Oregon income tax credits for child care. I won't go into that in detail, but it's fairly complete. It shows that the child independent care credit was started in 75 and changed a couple of times subsequent to that. The working family child care credit, as I mentioned, was established in 1997 legislature, and there was a bill passed in the last session, 1999 session, which made some changes, actually expanded eligibility to the working family child care credit, although those changes won't become effective until 2001 tax year.
These things can be pinged back together, like you can do an employer who is trying to cover all of their, this could put $2,500 towards a child care facility, and they could allow an employee to do up to $5,000 in a flexible spending account, and the amount that's over that, the employee could still deduct and get a credit from the income.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I know that if you make payments into a flexible spending account, tax-free flexible spending account, then you cannot also claim a child care credit.
On that portion.
Right.
Can you on the portion if it's over? I mean, most child care is going to be over $5,000 a year, I assume.
It could certainly
where I'm trying to get there, it might be easier to say, but what I'm trying to get, is there a way that you can mix and match these and get close to 100% of your childcare paid for?
That's your sense, but I believe so. I know, for example, that the two personal income tax credits are not mutually exclusive. You can, if you're eligible for both, you can claim both if you have sufficient tax liability. That won't often be the case, you know, as it turns out. And I imagine, yeah, I don't see any reason why if your employer were getting a credit for providing you with some expenses, but you had additional out-of-pocket expenses,
you could take a
claim credit for that. Next, I've provided a sheet which shows the historical utilization of child care and earned income tax credits. And the first thing I should point out is that the 1998 tax year numbers for the personal income tax are very rough. They were hot off the press late last week and haven't been adjusted for taxpayer tax liability. So I would expect that, for example, on 1998 Oregon earned income credit, the number of credit claims there, 165,720, and the total credits claimed, 13 million, will go down significantly once the claims are matched against tax liability and adjusted down for taxpayers' maximum tax liability. So the best data we have for the two new credits, the Oregon earned income credit and the working family credit, are really those 1997 numbers. 1997, approximately 154,000 taxpayers claimed Oregon earned income credits to the tune of about $9.5 million total credits claimed. Working family credit, about 15,000 credits were claimed in 1997 to a total of about $5.2 million. One thing that that's a trend to watch, I guess, is regarding the next credit, the Child Independent Care Credit. Since 1995, we've seen sort of a tailing off, a decrease in the number of credits claimed. And I think the trend actually goes back earlier than that. Part of that, I think, is that there's a cap, $45,000 federal taxable income cap on eligibility to claim that credit. And also, there's probably significant interaction or overlap between the Child Independent Care Credit and the new Working Family Child Care Credit. So for some taxpayers, it's probably more advantageous to use the Working Family Tax Credit than to use the Child Independent Care Credit. So we may well see the utilization and total credits claimed for that credit continue to decrease. The corporate credits are concerned, employer's credits. I've laid out 3 years of utilization. Again, the 1997, the numbers are preliminary, but for a different reason. In this case, the numbers are preliminary because not all returns have been filed by corporations for the 1997 tax year, and the returns are not yet complete. So we would expect to see those numbers change a bit. But for the last 2 years we have available, we have about 24 or 25 corporations claiming credit. 1997, the largest number so far, I believe, $2.2 million in total credits were claimed, mostly for facilities, I believe, child care facilities.
Under bias, the facilities, can employers claim the credit on a if they're only providing a portion, like, can multiple employers go together and support a daycare center?
Madam Chair, Senator Barr, I believe so. I don't see why they couldn't work out something like that. Finally, I'll refer you to the table titled Spendable Income Calculation. And there's a lot of numbers here. but what it shows, what I'm trying to show is what amount of benefit sort of a representative taxpayer family would get from the different Oregon tax benefits for child care. I lumped the earned income credit loosely in that category as well. But if you'll look down to that last block there right above the notes, and it shows what the the gain in spendable income is for this representative family due to these different tax credits. The first one, gain due to the child and to the child care credit, which is it's also called the child independent care credit. Next is the earned income credit. Next is that working family child care credit. And finally, the last line there shows the additional gain that we could expect from the changes due to the expanded eligibility in 1999 Senate Bill 2. And if you look across that row, you'll see that really the benefits of that expansion under Senate Bill 2 won't begin to kick in and benefit the taxpayer until you get up to that approximately $13 per hour wage level. So the reason for that is that taxpayers below that income level do not have sufficient tax liability to utilize all of the credits that are currently available.
All of them.
Right. This brings up another point, I guess. You're talking about, what is the cost of this credit or that credit in terms of the general fund revenue? Tax expenditures. It's a little bit difficult to say because on an income tax return, taxpayers calculate their total tax, and then they calculate the different credits that they choose to claim. They add all those up, and they can only offset tax with the amount of credit. If you have a credit more than tax, you don't get money back. You don't get your refundable credit. Which credits are they using to offset which portion of the tax? I don't know. Anybody's guess. Are they using the child care credit first? Are they using the earned income credit first? Are they using the working family credit first? It's hard to say. So the estimates of utilization of tax credits and cost of tax credits is an estimate. That's speculative.
Mm-hmm. Senator Beyer.
So, in effect, the various programs that we've tried to structure. Are you saying that they really don't have any effect at helping people under $13 an hour?
Senator Beyer, Madam Chairman of this committee, what I'm saying is that the changes that we just passed under Senate Bill 2, 1999 Senate Bill 2, don't have an impact until approximately that income level.
And this only relates to the personal credits. It doesn't relate to the employer side at all, then.
That's correct. Yeah, this is just really for personal income taxpayers, the tax credits, tax benefits that are available. When do those, how much would a representative taxpayer be able to take, and when do they kick in, when do they phase out, et cetera?
So if we were shooting at trying to help the people on the bottom end, provide good credit in our child care, we haven't been able to get out of tax credit tax policy.
That is correct. And the primary reason for that is that they don't have sufficient tax liability tax credit to be used. The last pages that I put in your packet are just copied from the tax expenditure report and give you some additional information about those tax programs. And with that, I'll turn things over to Wendy Willett and Dave Barenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dave Barenberg, and with me is Wendy Willett, who's the Executive Officer of the Child Care Commission. I'm before you today, and my capacity as a volunteer member of the Child Care Commission, having been appointed by the Senate President, and also as the co-chair of the Child Care Financing Task Force, which the Senate President had asked the Child Care Commission to establish and to report back on issues in affordability in child care. Today I feel especially well able to talk about child care after having just survived a sleepover with 13 8 and 9-year-olds at our house for my son's 9th birthday.
And they were boys?
They were 11 boys, 2 girls.
The 11 boys, I'm sure. I just remember my son at that age, with boys coming over are totally different than girls. And you have sustained
we have to move on.
Her.
Significant damage.
Yeah, that's right.
A little background on the commission, which is it's made up of 15 members appointed by the speaker, the president, and the governor, with the charge to raise and present to the governor issues or concerns relative and solutions to affordable, accessible, quality child care. And among the commission's 15 members are a wide array of individuals, three legislators, Senator Shannon, Representative Piercy, and Representative Patridge, as well as child care professionals, laborers, medical professionals, parents of kids in child care, et cetera. And the commission has held hearings throughout the state and really saw two major areas of concern. One was over safety in child care and safety and quality. And the legislature last session really did a wonderful job of addressing those through passing legislation. And I'd like to thank Senator Duncan for his leadership. And the second area was just the affordability. There really is a gap in affordability. The state has made major strides with the tax credits that Ed has just spoken about and with passage of Senate Bill 2. The Child Care Task Force, we tried to cast a wider net and not have just the usual human services child care suspects, but have a committee that was made up of business people, finance experts, and others, other creative thinkers, to look at the issue and see if there were any stones the state has left unturned. And we started by looking at the usual suspects. One, the business folks really wanted to have an in-depth look at, is there any way to reduce costs? And seeing that child care workers' wages were around $6.70 to $7.30 an hour for teachers and assistant teachers, and that's the primary cost is labor, the largest cost in child care, and other things, we sort of quickly went to getting more money into the system. Is there an ability to, you know, understand the individuals that are having problems and then try to identify ways of trying to alleviate the problems they had? The task force found that 59% of Oregon mothers with children younger than six and 77% of the women with children between 6 and 17 are in the labor force, and that about 67% of the households under 25 with incomes under 25,000 that have children report that child care is unaffordable, which is more than 10% of the household income, according to a 96 survey. And for example, and we found that given with the tax credits, and this is prior to Senate Bill 2, that a single-parent family with two children earning the minimum wage of $6.50 with a paying $626 for child care, so that's about $300 a child, they would qualify to receive 40% of the credit, but because the credit is non-refundable, as Ed had detailed, only 1% of the credit, about $8 a month, would be refunded on their tax return, so that while their low-income working family struggling to try to make it in the workplace, child care is a significant cost. The state has tried to mitigate that cost, but for those families, the state tax benefits only cover 1% of their child care costs. We found that the families with the greatest need, who are those families, are not eligible for most state subsidies and have low tax liability. So we really looked at that area and then one other as ways of trying to address that problem. The first was the way we always think of things, which is the best way to fund something is get somebody else to pay for it. And I don't mean that flippantly. I mean that in terms of looking at business as a partner in this. And on our task force, there were businesses who had offer child care benefits. And one, the co-chair of the commission, who is president of a temp service agency, offers a benefit to their temps, and she finds that it's in her business's interest to do so. In a hot labor market, it gives her an advantage. It has increased the stability and commitment of her workforce and has led one of the elements among many. I think having a creative president, as she is a major one, but of lending to a real successful business. Another member of the task force also, a larger corporation, offered the benefit. and saw it to their business advantage. So that while the cost is a benefit, the business can provide their employees and have it subsidized 50% from the state, has been a major success for these businesses. It's something that, as Ed's numbers show, only 25 corporations took advantage of. And the commission examined that, and one of the options was, gee, do you expand the credit? And the commission's feeling was that that wasn't what the problem was. It was really a problem of education, is that many of the employers don't realize that that benefit exists and what it entails, that our tax professionals, you know, don't necessarily learn about this in a tax school or what have you, in preparation school. And it was one where the state could benefit by having additional resources put into child care from the business community by just doing an outreach effort to the business community to let them see how it is in their own interest and make that decision when they see the facts. But it just isn't in the realm of the discussions going on in business community and compensation. So that was one fairly low-cost recommendation, was just to have a position, short-term duration, to do some education work for the business community. The second...
Has the commission looked at in sort of a cost-benefit to an employer of providing child care 100% as opposed to increasing salaries? I hear that... A lot of the companies in my area that I'm working with are trying to figure out how to get labor and what's the best thing, and some of them are talking about childcare, some of them are talking about providing housing as a niche rather than increasing wages, and I don't know if there's a benefit, if there's been an examination of the benefit of doing that as opposed to necessarily increasing the labor, the wage level. It's still an increase in cost to the company, but which you get the best bang for your buck out of?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, does Wendy have more information than I do?
For the record, Wendy Willett, Commission for Child Care. I think you raise a really good point. In discussing this issue with businesses statewide, one of the things that we have found is that businesses jump from looking at child care as an issue in their business, and they think, let's develop a child care center. But we know, because Oregon businesses are primarily small, that doesn't work for businesses. And so one of the pieces around looking at the whole issue is really determining what the workforce really truly needs. And that can be extremely diverse, from subsidizing the child care cost, which is, I think, what you're kind of looking at. And I think businesses still need to have the cost-benefit analysis that says this is in my best interest financially to do so. And I think part of what David was speaking about in terms of an outreach effort is really getting businesses that data, that piece that says this is why it makes good business sense for me to provide a subsidy or to provide some type of assistance to my employees. And I think there's information out there. There was a toolkit that was developed by the Commission for Child Care and the Commission on Children and Family and the Employment Department and several other partners that looks at kind of the wide range of what are the work-life benefits and how they impact businesses. But unfortunately, I think the learning process, the curve has been slow. I think businesses are getting on board, but I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that area. So in a roundabout way, that's kind of where they're at right now.
As a part of your outreach, you mentioned some agencies and so forth that came together and made this toolkit. I'm wondering, as a part of the outreach, for instance, to NFIB members or to NFIB to give to their members, as well as, Associated Oregon Industries or the larger corporations, it just seems to me that this, with the workforce as it is and the very low rate of unemployment, it's got to be even... McDonald's Corporation or whatever, for these employees who need child care, it's got to be to their advantage to keep a workforce, to be able to offer some kind of subsidy, and then, to have 50% a credit to them.
At the lower end, it's rather discouraging to see that the credit really doesn't help much at the bottom end.
For the actual, for the single taxpayer, but for the corporation being able to do that for them.
Well, it's only a benefit to the corporation if it results in a better relationship with the employees.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a cost on the corporate side, but the issue really becomes in this tight labor market is how do you get labor? And you're looking at someone having $626 a month payments. If you can just take that off completely, and I don't know what that translates into.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do it in my head sick enough, but the question is it better to raise the wage to $8 an hour or pay for the child care?
Mm-hmm.
The cost to the company may be the same.
It may be, but as I say, they may have better longevity of their employees. And mm-hmm. as you say, the relationship between the employer-employee.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe kind of hope
that. Yeah, because not everybody maybe will do it, and that employer who does it in an area, even if it is in the lower income range that they're paying, if they want to keep those people there and not have a rotating
well,
workforce.
Another job for 25
yeah, right. And I'm that has to be a problem.
That may get to the point where it might be if you're trying to use tax policy, and tax policy may not be the best way to get at this thing, it may be more effective to encourage employers, give them a higher deduction than employees because they're more likely to reap the benefit off of it, and you actually
right.
get more dollars going to the employee.
Right. And that you would, I think, in turn, reach into that pool of individuals who at this point in time are not being able to take advantage of a credit because they don't, their liability isn't high enough to take
I hadn't thought about it, man.
Yeah.
Just a different way of looking
at
it.
That's why men and women sit on committees here and
yeah.
have a different viewpoint.
Okay. I'm just curious, man, Gary. You know, too, you mentioned the NFIB, National Federation of Business. Have they been doing studies now? Are you aware of anything? Because, you know, as you say, it's maybe to their benefit. And I wonder if they're where their awareness level is and what they're doing at this particular time. Do we know?
I unfortunately do not know.
It's an interesting thing to see if it's on their agenda, at least a study of what's
going
on.
I bet it is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the marketplace, it's the labor issue that's really going
right.
to drive it now.
Yeah.
I'd like to say that they're doing it out of the kindness of their heart.
Oh, mm-hmm.
The reality is that employers across the board, in at least the urbanized area, and we recognize mm-hmm. there's a difference in the rural areas, are having a hard time getting employees, and they're searching for how to make it work.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is not out of the goodness of their heart. They have other heart issues about, you know, keeping their business going. I mean, small businesses, they're a risk anyway,
mm-hmm.
many of them. I mean, and you've got a day-to-day heavy-chested feeling. I think back to my days of owning a small business and keeping good employees. I mean, the interest is, you don't want to be retraining somebody every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's much better spent in a different way. The other angle, I don't know if you've been in contact with chambers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, that would be one way. Sometimes that doesn't translate. Yeah, chambers of commerce.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean, chambers of commerce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the U.S. chamber, the regular chamber, local chambers. So that they can get that to their members, but I actually think some of the other associations, like NFIB and mm-hmm. other small business men's would be.
I think your point was well taken about male female kind of thing. I think, you know, there's this whole concept of childcare. Males not.
Mm-hmm.
They've not really identified with it very closely.
Yeah, they might to a certain degree. I just know
yeah,
I was a single mother
well,
that
I
had a couple kids.
Yeah, I think they're getting much more involved in it than everything.
Mm-hmm.
I just was thinking, I'm not looking at this thing, I'm just thinking of my own attitude. I have a new granddaughter, and my son-in-law has been off his family leave, which you know, I'm still of a generation where, you know, I went back to work that afternoon.
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
Which now my thinking is really changing all of a sudden, saying, hey, wait a minute, this is a different world, and these
mm-hmm.
kids need that mom.
Yeah.
Know,
Yeah.
It was a different experience. My assistant is off on maternity leave, and I'm trying to figure out any way to get her back quick. You know, it's hard to
bring the baby with
you. That's fine.
Yeah, right.
Madam Chair, one anecdotal story, too, is I was back east visiting family and shopping at a shopping center, and there was a leaflet left on all the cars in the shopping center which said, jobs available holiday season, you know, the retail, child care benefits provided. What? And so they saw that the labor market being tight is the place we have to dig deeper in is going to be folks who require child care.
Did that work?
I don't know. I'd be interested to find those shopping now whether they say there's enough help there as Christmas approaches. But I think there are studies, and Senator Beyer tried to see if we can find them trying to look at the issue of how it impacts the workforce to have child care. Some of it I think was on site that I recall before, but probably also benefits in terms of workforce, longevity and other things.
Does your toolkit give a model for an employer to be able to sort of do the math on that?
Senator Beyer, Madam Chair, yes, it does, absolutely. Actually, the toolkit is a pretty comprehensive look at different work-life benefits ranging anywhere from telecommuting to allowing parents to bring the children to work. And then it does look at the different kinds of tax benefits that are available for businesses who provide subsidies or cafeteria plans, a flexible spending account, or on-site child care, kind of on the spectrum of things, and goes into the cost-benefit analysis and how to look at really calculating the cost of what does it take to do different benefits. And some of the what we have found, anecdotally throughout the nation, actually, is that the number one thing employees want from their employer is flex time, being able to have a flexible type of schedule, and to be able to not have to use after-school care, to be able to be home at 3 o'clock when the kids get there. And so that's one of the things that doesn't cost employers a lot of money. And so really looking at the broad spectrum of what is it that my employee demographics really, truly need. And I think that companies, the toolkit is one way of looking at some of those things, though it doesn't give you everything an employer would want to know. And we do know from the process that an employer might start looking at having some work-life benefits in their company, but the actual period of time that it takes for them to actually implement them can be anywhere from a year to 3 years. And so it takes time. So I think the data is really starting to be out there, and there's lots of national data that says this really improves productivity and longevity and morale for employees, and all that data is there. Oregon has been a little behind in terms of really looking at statistically what Oregon employers are doing with work-life benefits, as well as Ed and I have spoken of this several times, even looking at getting some data on the small corporations that are not being listed in here. They're just falling under the regular income tax. And so really looking at what Oregon employers are doing, because we know, I know from talking to employers statewide that there are many employers who are subsidizing childcare, but they're not following any corporation numbers because they're small. Even Hannah Anderson, who was on our workforce financing task force, they don't fall in the numbers that we can actually pull out and look at those numbers of companies who are providing that benefit.
We can provide, Madam Chair, the committee with just that packet for employers so that you can look at it, and we'd appreciate any feedback, if you think we could connect better, and any other ideas. You have some good ideas today for us. The last area, which was really the second area, just goes back to the numbers that Ed was sharing before, which is the hole that the financing task force found was those who are at the bottom end, working families, trying to often make it off of state assistance rolls, but are just below the level of getting benefits of the tax credits, but still have high expenses. It was in the $8 scenario that Ed had laid out, as you see that if you're earning $5.50 or $6.22, and then jump up to $8 an hour, you sustain a loss of income from about $17,500 to around $16,000. And so, as you're sort of climbing out, getting your second pay raise often, that you then take a big hit. Part of it is because you lose your food stamps, but you also then don't have the benefit of the deductibility. And so the task force recommendation was that we have a refundable tax credit to try to address those who are working but don't yet have an income sufficient to have the benefits of the tax credit and are the ones who are really the most in need. We applaud the efforts of Senate Bill 2 and prior to that for the working family tax credits has done a great deal for working families, but we still have this hole, and that was our recommendation, is that we have a refundable tax credit to try to address that hole there. And with that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come before you today.
Okay, thank you. Senator Bynum.
Maybe to add, has there been a look at the, we're at 40% of the reimbursable level up to the poverty level and everything. What would it, how much difference would it make if we were allowing 100% credit to some kind of declining? And that's because I guess I'm saying you pay no income, no federal tax, no state taxes at all if you're paying too much for your child. Does that make much of a difference?
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, that probably would not have a large impact under the current structure because the credit is non-refundable. The point that Dave made that even though someone in this income range is on paper eligible to receive credit for 40% of the child care expenses, due to their low tax liability, they're in fact only able to take much less than that, maybe only 1% to 5% of their child care expenses.
And that's the issue that they're essentially, if you're making under $10 an hour, you're looking at the state tax liability is about $2,000, $3,000 max.
Senator Byrne, members of the committee, yes, I think probably much lower than that, actually. I think that's on the table that I, the federal income table, yeah, $10 category. If you look down, about a third of the way down the page, Oregon income tax, net Oregon tax before credit. Net Oregon tax before credit for someone in the $10 per hour range, about $913. That's before any income tax credit. So they can effectively offset all of their income tax liability with the existing mix of credits if they fell into that category head to
here's
care.
A scenario in here, the $600 a month child care.
Right.
It's 1.5 months, and you're taking care of the guys.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Looks like we're a little ahead of schedule here. And so we will just move in. Thank you, Ed, for your help on this. So the next thing that we're going to hear about here is the highway cost responsibility. Right. I saw the person walking in who must have been watching the TV to see that we were nearing the child care credit.
Did you guess anyway?
Yeah, thank you.
I just mean you have to fill in the whole time, Dick.
What?
No, I was kidding, Dick. So it doesn't mean he has to fill in the whole time, though.
No, no. It means we might have a longer lunch hour, and unless there's somebody renting out.
That'd be good to start early.
Yeah.
Well, actually, just a second. We might want to, we probably can't.
Advertised this way, probably is.
I was just going to say, even the revenue forecast or something. And I don't think we could get going on the tobacco settlement, but if we were to finish on this early, we might consider the revenue forecast.
Some people coming over from Donna's.
I know.
Yeah.
That's why I'm mentioning it now. Maybe they could. That's several. It's. DOJ.
That'd be good.
Oh, yeah. That's right. So we'd just leave early and then come back early. Yeah, that'd be good. Probably be a better way of doing it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it wouldn't. So.
Right. Okay.
right. Members of the committee, the Section 3A of Article 9 of the Oregon Constitution dedicates any tax levied on the sale or distribution of motor vehicle fuel or any tax or excise levied on the ownership, operation, or use of motor vehicles to expenditures for operations, maintenance, and repair, essentially, of highways and roads throughout the state. In November, the initiative petition was passed, which are your referral to the voters, essentially, was passed, and that adds a new Section 3 to that article in the Constitution. And what that requires, which is new as far as the revenue committees are concerned, is that you look at the tax structure which the state imposes to raise highway user fees, and that's the fuel taxes which are levied by the state, registration fees, and various other permit fees, and you essentially divide the vehicles that are using the highways into two groups, light vehicles and heavy vehicles, and it requires that you make the tax structure under which these different vehicles are paying, that you arrange that such that each of those groups pays an amount which is proportional to the amount of costs that are expended on the highways for each of those classes of vehicles. Now, there's traditionally the highway cost allocation study is what has looked at the question of what is the cost responsibility for different classes of vehicles. And traditionally, again, that's looked forward in the sense that they look at the STIP and what is going to be spent, and they take those expenditures that are planned and allocate them between, you know, whether it's simply building minimal type of structure required for light vehicles, or whether there's extra expenditures required to handle the heavier vehicles, such as bridge design, pavement thickness, things of that sort. And so those costs are allocated then to the different classes of vehicles. And in the past, you've essentially used the weight mile tax structure as a means of adjusting the fees within that. The fees under the weight mile tax are per mile that's traveled on the road. They apply only to the heaviest vehicles, 26,000 pounds and above. And that is incremented in each 2,000 pounds. So you have a lot of flexibility in terms of ability to modify the proportion that the different weighted vehicles are paying. Now, this doesn't, you know, this is constitutional language, and it's not, this is what you now have in the Constitution. And it's not real binding. It does not define what binding in this sense. It does not define what's light and what are heavy vehicles. And it doesn't say whether you should be looking forward again toward the STIP and what you're going to spend, or whether you want to look back and say, well, what damage did they do historically? How were the expenditures actually spent, rather than looking forward in terms of what the planned expenditures are? And that is in the Constitution now. You may have some clarifying language added statutorily if House Bill 2082 passes. There's language in that. If it does not, if it fails, it has been, there's a referendum on that bill, and you will vote, people will vote on that on May 15th. If that fails, there will be no further statutory language clarifying exactly what you want to be done here to meet this constitutional responsibility. So you may want to come back and do make, you know, make some statutory definitions of what, for example, constitutes light vehicles, what constitutes heavy vehicles. You may want to give DAS some direction requiring them to provide you the type of information you'll need to comply with this. And those are kind of the things that are addressed here in House Bill 2082. If that does pass, what you have is a requirement that DAS do highway cost allocation studies every 2 years, and that they report back to the legislature along with the results of the study, recommendations for how you can adjust the registration fees at least, which are what's addressed here in ORS 803-4-2010. Those are the heavy vehicle, commercial vehicle registration fees. How you can modify those to achieve to comply essentially with constitutional requirement.
Let me just ask a question there. We're talking about weight on vehicles, whether it's a truck or car or whatever. Is the destruction done to highways by studded tires taken into account, and is that charged against the cars?
Yes, it is taken into account. That's always been a thorny issue in the past because you're generally, as I said, you've traditionally looked forward as to how you're going to spend the money. And studded tire has always been, the analysis has always been, well, what damage was done? Mm-hmm. You've got a little bit of apples and oranges in terms of the way the comparison was made. Those costs in the past have all been allocated to basic vehicles. The light vehicles. And the estimates have varied substantially in terms of the amount of damage that was done. This last highway cost allocation study that was done, Roger Mingo, who was one of the consultants, actually added some equations into the pavement allocation model, which took into consideration the amount of damage that's done by studded tires. So that was actually brought into and made a part of the model rather than being a separate analysis and being an adjustment to the analysis.
We ought to do that if we're going to maintain the same policy that we have had regarding studded tires, I think.
It seems like me, the voters did buy the fact that we should do the cost study. And so I would say that what's at issue in the initiative by the referendum on 2082 is really more the tax increase rather than the methodology. The methodology statement, if DAS needs some direction on that, probably makes some sense for us to do that, or as Dick and the revenue office would suggest, we adjust that. So we need something for next time, and you can't wait until May to start the process.
We certainly, if I may address that issue, don't want to be where we were last time.
And the voters have pretty clearly spoken that they want the study done. The question is how to do it.
It is in the process right now, and RPF has gone out, I believe, or will go out very shortly, which is asking for another round, essentially, to do essentially a full highway cost allocation study and planning to spend the same amount of money, which was around $230,000, I think. I'm not sure exactly what it was. It's higher than that. That's what's involved for the contractor. But then, of course, if you count in the resources that the department has dedicated to it, it's substantially more.
Then we get to a point, I realize the first one is real expensive and the second one is going to be expensive because you're adjusting it, but when we're doing it on a biannual basis, do we get to the point where we can ramp that cost down because it's you're doing the same thing?
The constitutional amendment certainly gives you that flexibility. And the language that's in the in 2082, if it passes, says, you know, it addresses either a full highway cost responsibility study or an examination of the data collected since the previous study. So it's sort of an update, which would be considerably less expensive.
Well, I guess I'm asking in a different way. I'm not saying which way. I'm just saying from your professional opinion, once we get this trend, you know, the process established, do we get to a point where we can stay with the intent of the voters in terms of keeping up on what cost responsibility is, but lower that curve, that cost curve?
Of the study.
Yeah, that's a hard question, I think. It's not like an accounting project where you design a system and then you just use the system, because it's a living thing in the sense that they're learning a lot. They're addressing a broader range of issues continually over time. And to the extent that you try to bring in, say, congestion pricing or pollution, questions of pollution or noise pollution or air pollution into the analysis and broaden it and make it better in that sense, the costs are likely to go up rather than down.
I haven't heard anybody talk about bringing mm-hmm. those pieces in. I thought we were just talking about maintaining the pavement. Maintaining capacity, not the the environmental side of it.
Well, those mm-hmm. those questions are always out there. There's nothing...
I realize they're out there. I'm just saying I don't think the legislature has taken that step there yet. Maybe we did, and I didn't realize mm-hmm. it, but I don't think we've taken that
Well, I think that's one of the things you might want to address in terms of making it clear what you expect to be involved in the decision, which complies then with the constitutional requirement.
And those things were not in the model that was run last time.
Again, because of time constraints, I think last time there were some things that were not done. It was a recommendation of the contractor that be pursued as an area, and it was pursued sort of indirectly in terms of the definition of what constitutes modernization, where the argument was that the contractor was making is that what's driving a lot of 217 type investments, the Dundee bypass or things mm-hmm. like that, is congestion.
Mm-hmm.
And that the cost of those expansions should really be borne more heavily by light vehicles because that's where the congestion is occurring. Whether you want to identify projects as modernization projects and capacity driven and treat them different in terms of the way in which you allocate those costs back to basic vehicles and heavy vehicles is an open question which needs to be addressed. But it's also one which you can certainly it's a policy question, and the legislature should have some input and should be thinking about
this. Well, I would think, given where we're at, in fact, we've already got an RP, that what we would want to do in the next 2 years is do just an update or repeat, whatever the right words is, of the formula, the process we used the last time. And then those other policy questions about whether it should be brought or not really needs to be in the 2001 yeah. assembly.
Yeah, part of the real big change in the tax structure if 2082 does pass is going to be, require substantial change. We couldn't just take the model that was developed, the 99 model, and apply that very well to the new tax structure, so that we do need a fairly full study this time. In view of the new tax structure, the way that we analyze the data.
But does that get at the environmental factors and the changes in classification and modernization?
Well, we'll see what the contractors come back with. There is the way the DOS sets this up is that they have a study review team, I think it's called, and they evaluate the proposals by the contractors and sort of set the ball game or the dimensions of how they want the study done. And so they're making decisions, again, about whether you're looking at the STIP or whether you want to look backward at cost. They're making a lot of decisions that are involved very significantly in how the results come out. For example, the allocation of subsidies. You have charitable vehicles and you have government vehicles and a lot of vehicles that don't pay their full share of the taxes, and you end up with a substantial amount of money there, which is not paid. So you've got vehicles that are causing cost damage or that are causing money to be spent on the highways. They're not paying for it. Somebody's got to pay for it. Now, within you don't have general fund appropriation for that, even though you have established those favorable treatments. So they are subsidized by other highway users.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, how do you allocate those back again among heavy and light vehicles?
Well, Dick, Mike, I guess let me just explain. It's a concern because I don't know how to articulate it more than that. I think the next one, the one that's going to be done for the next assembly, as much as possible, needs to be apples to apples with the one that was done the last time. And I recognize that within that, you need to get some additional, may need to get some additional information if 2082 passes, but I'd hate to get into the debate in January 2001 of, now that's not the same study we did the last time, or
I think the
Steady Review team
has talked about that, and I think the intent there is to maintain as much comparability as possible. But I will carry that message to them. So I am on the Study Review team.
And hopefully we wouldn't divert into these new areas of trying to measure environmental costs and the cost of policing and all those other things, which I think are real costs, but that's a kind of big policy shift that I don't think people have thought through, and particularly this legislature has not thought through. Mainly we're talking about the difference, the depth of the pavement and the width of the pavement. And
well, of course, as technology changes also, you're going to be faced eventually, and I think fairly shortly, with the question of whether you want to introduce actual congestion pricing as a means of raising revenue for purposes of building the highway. You know, you've got systems that are available and in use now in Australia and various places where they use satellites. They have essentially a small electronic computer on each vehicle that communicates. The information is stored, and you're charged per mile a price as an automobile for use of the highway.
But we're not there yet.
We're not there yet. But
for toll roads on State Road 91 in California, they are.
That's right.
Toll roads.
Well,
we've authorized two.
I mean, actually, they're private. Yeah, they're private. The one in California was built right in the median.
Yeah.
In a very congested area, and it's doing well. People are willing to go there. Mm-hmm. And believe me, there is so much congestion in some parts
of
Washington County, in Yamhill County probably, that they're getting ready, although I think we should wait.
Well, it would really be, I
and
think
pressure.
It would take to move too far.
Yeah, I do too. That's right. I agree.
The second page is just the vote. Last week, the Secretary of State released the vote from the November election, and I just sorted it there so you could look at the counties on the east side and the west side separately.
Mm-hmm.
The measure did not pass on the east side.
No.
The vote being 47%, yes.
I just.
But it passed enough on the west side to carry it for a overall 54.2%.
I just quickly looked at the 9 top counties and of the percentage of voting, and 3 voted aye, and the rest were against it of the top counties. I don't know what that means.
You mean the size?
No, I didn't look at size, the percentage of voting.
Mm-hmm.
And the highest voting counties, there were 9 of them. There were 30% or more of the turnout of vote.
It's pretty it's pretty clear that the most populous area is the one.
Right.
With the exception of my county. It's suburban.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I have just anecdotally, my county, my predecessor, Senator Dwyer, now Commissioner Dwyer, was campaigning against it. Is the one that's screaming they need more road tax money.
That is interesting, isn't it?
The vote on this measure was 26.7% of the registered voters voted on the east side, and 26.5%. So it's fairly balanced in this sense. It's pretty low.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really low.
It would not have made it on a double majority.
Obviously.
Stay right there, that's a pretty good percentage, 54%.
Overall, approval, you mean, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you do see some areas like Washington County where it passed fairly significantly that really bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
No, right.
That was the highest percentage.
Okay.
Yes, vote, wasn't it, in Washington County?
I noticed that. Are there any further questions for Dick here about this measure? If not, thank you, Dick, for your presentation. And
did you get the instruction you needed? You were asking some questions in terms of the study?
I think so, yeah.
If there's no further discussion, we will recess for, oh, I'm sorry, Ed. Aha, you have the toolkit?
Oh, cool.
Oh, as Chair members of the committee, we have the employer's toolkit.
Right, oh, good. Okay. Thank you very much.
An extra set, was that yours?
Nope.
Okay, we are going to adjourn then until 1 o'clock. Your schedule says 1:30.
Recess.
I'm sorry, recess, I started that. Recess until 1 o'clock.